So today we're going to pick up where we left off in Ezekiel, and we're going to try to cover chapters 45 and 46. And if you don't remember, there's only 48 chapters in the book of Ezekiel, so we're getting fairly close to the end. I hope to finish next week and do a summary next week. If I don't finish next week, then we'll do the summary the following week. You know, the book of Ezekiel is a wonderful book, and I think you, if you've been with us the time or you listened online or listened to most of them, you understand more about this book than you probably ever have, and you understand a little bit about the man, Ezekiel, and the message that he brought, and we'll summarize it more when we get to the end, but I think it's a pretty powerful message. Notwithstanding the problem that we have in understanding the book, the book is a book of metaphors. It's a book of apocalyptic literature, which means it uses a lot of symbols. Ezekiel saw things and wrote them down that we don't know what they are. He didn't know what they are other than what the angel told him. And his description are based on, you know, 700 BC understanding of the world. So, you know, you look at that and you marvel at it. And what I would just say is, with all of Ezekiel, today's lesson no different, don't get really hung up in some of the details about it, because the details will become important if we're meant to know them. If they were not meant to know them, they won't. So for the Jews who survived to the millennial kingdom, Ezekiel's temple and the cubits and all of that is real important. For us who are raptured out, it's interesting to understand what God's purpose and plan is, but we're not going to have to build this temple. We're not going to be there to see it in operation, except if we see it from heaven, because we'll be in heaven, and then we'll come back, you know, as part of the redeemed that come during the millennial kingdom. But, you know, as church, we're not part of the Jewish operation that goes on there. It's kind of interesting, because there's a lot of holes in that whole subject, which people have lots of theories about, but don't always understand. I was going to pass around, and I'll do it now. I forgot to do it. What did I do with it? Oh, it's right here. With the thing about the prayer request, and sorry I didn't update it, because I haven't been at home to do it this week, so I'll get it updated sometime in the next few days and get it out. So there's probably a pin somewhere.
Right there.
Yeah, that's my personal pin, but I'll pass it around.
Look at it.
It's not my ace pin, because I'm not at home where I have that with me, but that pin will do anyway. My recorder's on, yeah. So I'll try to make a note of everything. But so I guess my point is, Ezekiel is a book that we can know a lot about, and it's a book we don't know a lot about, and we just have to be content that what we don't know is because God is not ready for us to understand it yet. But that as we come back and as progressive revelation happens, we will understand more of it when it's time to be understood. So we're going to pick up today in Ezekiel chapter 45. And we're going to read through. There's a couple of things that I think are real important here. Not that it's not all important, but there's a couple of things that I think are important to us as we go through. And this is one of two chapters, 45 and I believe 47, that talk about the division of the land. And I'm going to pass something out. I tried to make a better copy, but I didn't get a better copy, so I'm going to pass something out, and I think there's 25 of them here, so share them if you can. We'll just divide it in half and do it that way. This is a map out of the book here, which shows the division of the land, which we're going to talk about in both chapters 45 and 47. And to actually see it on a map, it makes it a little easier as we go through it to understand it. But there's also a little bit of the text on the land boundaries over there, which I couldn't figure out on the copier how to mask off and make it any bigger. So I'll put a better one up on the website if you want to download it when I've get home and you get my own scanner and do all that stuff. But right now, this will be what we'll use today. So let's look at chapter 45 and begin. When you allot the land as an inheritance, you are to present to the Lord a portion of the land as a sacred district. Okay, so look at this map and look at this little center part right here where you see a set of rectangles that are stacked up. One says priests, one says Levites, and one says workers. And this is what we're going to talk about, that and the two parcels next to it, the ones that say P or prince. We're going to talk about those today. The others we talk about in chapter 47. So you're to present to the Lord a portion of the land as a sacred district, 25,000 cubits long and 20,000 cubits wide. The entire area will be holy. Just for reference, 25,000 cubits, long cubits, is 8.28 miles. If it's not long cubits, it's a little above 7 miles. And you can figure, you know, four-fifths of that, 80% of that is the width. So you've got about an 8 mile swath of land he's talking about now. And it's if you see the little line here, you can see where the long line is. You know, the long line is east to west, and the short line is north to south. You can see kind of the position of that. Of this, a section 500 cubit squares to be for the sanctuary, with 50 cubits surrounded for open land. So he's talked about building the sanctuary, talked about building the temple, and so that's going to be located in this portion of the allocation. In the sacred district, measure off a section 25,000 cubits by 10,000 cubits wide, and it will be the sanctuary, the most holy place. It will be the sacred portion of the land for the priests who minister in the sanctuary and who draw near to minister before the Lord. It will be a place for their houses as well as a holy place for the sanctuary. An area 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 cubits wide will belong to the Levites. That's the area just to the south of that, who serve in the temple as their possession for towns to live in. So let me just kind of separate this now. You've got this portion where the city is. You've got the house of the priests. What he's talking about here are the priests, sons of Zadok, those that will minister inside the holiest part of the sanctuary. For the other priests, the Levites, he's got a separate section of land set off for them where their houses are. So they both live in the section. Remember last week we talked about the fact that God was not going to allow the priest to, they were going to get all of their possessions from the Lord and from the people. They weren't going to own their own property. They weren't going to do a lot of things because of the graft and greed and corruption that they had done in the early days of the kingdoms. So he's going to prevent that by not giving them anything. And so they're going to live off the generosity and off the tithes and off the sacrifices and off the offerings of the people as they do the work of the Lord. So it will be a place for their houses as well as a holy place for the sanctuary. An area 25,000 cubits and 10,000 cubits wide will belong to the Levites who serve in the temple. Again, they're the ones who prepare the animals for sacrifice, who, you know, get rid of the skins, drain the blood, do all the nasty work of preparing for the sacrifices. And then the priests inside are the ones that take that and then do something with it and get close to the Lord. These priests don't. Verse 5, you are to give the city as property an area of 5,000 cubits wide, 25,000 cubits long, adjoining the sacred portion, and it will belong to the whole house of Israel. So if you look at your little map, you see the priests' allocation. These are the sons of Zadok. You see the Levites, who are the kind of the casual priests. And then you see the bottom area there where it says workers, but that's also the area for the whole house of Israel. So that's where the people will live, who will minister and do other things, the whole house of Israel. So it doesn't belong to a particular tribe. It doesn't belong to the Levites, doesn't belong to the sons of Zadok. It belongs to the whole house of Israel, and it's the city. Now, one thing I want to call your attention to is if you've been to Jerusalem, you know that the Temple Mount is right in the city, the heart of Jerusalem. So what this tells us is when the millennial kingdom appears and comes to be, the city sculpture will not be the same as it is now. Now, we know that because of earthquakes. We know that the mountains split. We know that the big mountains are brought low and some others are raised up. So the topography of Israel is going to look a lot different. So we know that the sanctuary is in this upper area and the city is in this lower area, which could be as much as 3 times 8 miles, 24 miles away. You know, it's, you know, whether it's in the top of one and the bottom of the other, or it's probably going to be mostly about 20 miles, 18 to 20 miles south of where the sanctuary is, but a distance. Just keep that in mind. And let me see here.
Seven,
thank you. The prince will have the land bordering each side of the area formed by the sacred district and property of the city. So if you look at your map, you'll see the P marked, which is the property of, I assume, David, the prince, who will own that property, and his heirs will be on that property. He's out of the tribe of Benjamin, so it'll be that property for his personal heirs. And it's interesting because as you go through, if you pay attention, you'll notice the duties of the prince might not be what you expect. They're different. They're sacramental duties that are done for the Lord, for the temple, for the people. But we don't see some of the other duties he may have here. The prince will have the land bordering each side of the area formed by the sacred district and the property of the city. It'll extend westward from the west side and eastward from the east side, running lengthwise from the western to eastern border, parallel to one of the tribal portions. So if you look to the west, it goes all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. If you look to the east, it goes all the way to the Jordan River. So those are the borders of Israel in this following kingdom. And the prince owns all of that land. You can see, by the way, in the economies of the map that there are no Palestinian territories. This is not a Palestinian map. This is a Jewish map about what God is going to do in the millennial kingdom. It says, This land will be his possession in Israel, and my princes will no longer oppress my people, but will allow the house of Israel to possess the land according to their tribes. Again, this speaks to the problems they had with the high priest, who became very wealthy, if they weren't already, by confiscating land and doing things. I mean, we see it. We saw it in the kings of Israel. We see it in kings of every other nation, you know, where they decide they want a piece of property and they just take it because they can. And, you know, that was true in the nation of Israel as well. And so that's not going to be true in this millennial kingdom. The prince is going to have his allocated land and that's it. The rest of it is not going to be his. And the people will of the house of Israel will possess the land according to their tribes. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. You have gone far enough, O princes of Israel. Give up your violence and oppression and do what is just and right. Stop dispossessing my people, declares the Sovereign Lord. You are to use accurate scales and accurate ephah and accurate bath. The ephah and the bath are to be the same size, the bath containing a tenth of a homer and the ephah a tenth of a homer. So everybody know all what that is. So let me just explain to you. Two of these are dry measures. The ephah is a tenth of a homer, and a homer is about 6 bushels. So these are dry measures. So 6 bushels of grain would be a homer. A tenth of that would be an ephah, which is kind of a scoop that they would use to parcel out grain. On the other hand, a hin, H-I-N, is 4 quarts of liquid, like oil. Could be oil, could be anything, but 4 quarts. And a bath is a tenth of a hin. So a bath is not a bath like we think of a bath. A bath here is a liquid measure, about a tenth of 4 quarts, or about 4/10 of a quart, which is, you know, less than half a quart, little more than what, 2 pints. So you or around 2 pints. So you can kind of think of them that way if it makes more sense to you. Your Bible may actually put those measurements in there, but these are the Hebrew words for that. And he goes on to say, you are to use accurate scales. So whenever you weigh and measure, whatever you do will be done accurately. It won't be done, you know, haphazardly, so the princes and the priests can get all the extra. It'll be done, you know, according to the way God's laid it out. The ephah and the bath are to be used are the same size, the bath containing a tenth of a homer, and the ephah a tenth of a homer. The homer, it's like an ounce. An ounce can be a dry weight ounce, or it can be a liquid ounce. So here, you could, and Mackey says they're both a tenth, but one's liquid measure and one's dry measure. And then he goes on to define money. The shekel, which is money, is to consist of 20 gerahs. 20 shekels plus 25 shekels plus 15 shekels equals one mina. Well, that's 60 shekels to a mina. So just file that away. It's not useful today when you go to Israel because they use American dollars and they use what's called NISs, which is new Israeli shekels. And the NISs are worth about a quarter. So four of them is worth about a dollar. So it's kind of interesting. They almost every place you go will take American dollars or Israeli shekels, and they'll give you back change generally in whatever you give them. Although sometimes if they don't have American change, they'll give you back Israeli money for, you know, which is real confusing to try to figure it all out, but they're pretty honest, I guess, at least they appear to be. So anyway, you just have to trust them on the small stuff. 13, offerings and holy days. This is the special gift you are to offer, a sixth of an ephah from each homer of wheat and a sixth of an ephah from each homer of barley. The prescribed portion of oil measured by the bath is a tenth of a bath from each core, which consists of 10 baths or one homer. I didn't define core, but that's 10 baths or one. I guess homer has two names, core and homer. Don't ask me. I don't know. Which contains 10 baths or one homer. For 10 baths are equivalent to a homer. Also, one sheep is to be taken from every flock of 200 from the well-watered pastures of Israel. These will be used for the grain offering, the burnt offering, the fellowship offering, to make atonement for the people, declares the Sovereign Lord. Remember last time we looked at atonement for the actual altar. We talked about, you know, we don't normally think of atonement for a physical thing like an altar, but that was to purify it and get it ready for the sacrifices. Now we're seeing the atonement for the people. All the people of the land will participate in this special gift for the use of the prince in Israel. Now, I interpret all the people of the land to be all of the house of Israel and all of the others who are not of the house of Israel that live in the land of Israel. And you'll see there are multiples of, they call them aliens here, which means I'm sure the Hebrew word is, you know, Gentile or whatever they call non-Jews in Hebrew. So they'll participate as well. It'll be the duty of the prince to provide burnt offerings, grain offerings, drink offerings at the festivals, the new moons, and the Sabbaths at all the appointed feasts of the house of Israel. He'll provide sin offerings, grain offerings, burnt offerings, and fellowship offerings to make atonement for the house of Israel. So all of these sacrifices are given to the prince, but the prince saves a lot of them and brings them to the feasts and the offerings because he's the one that brings the final offering in to be dealt with and burned by the princes of Zadok and all of that. So new moon here is the first day of a month, which is the day of the new moon, a full moon, a new moon. And, of course, the Sabbath. And don't try to keep track of when they're going to do feasts and what feasts and all that because it'll drive you crazy. But they don't do as many feasts as they do in Leviticus. So some of the feasts have gone away, but some of them remain, and you'll see which ones do. This is what the Sovereign Lord says: in the first month, on the first day, you're to take a young bull without defect and purify the sanctuary. The priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering and put it on the doorposts of the temple, on the four corners of the upper ledge of the altar, and on the gateposts of the inner court. You're to do the same on the seventh day of the month for anyone who sins unintentionally or through ignorance, so you are to make atonement for the temple. Now, this is interesting phrasing because in Jewish atonement, they don't attend for sins like this are not covered by blood on the altar. They're covered elsewhere, and like David and Bathsheba and all of that. These are for unintentional sins. You know, I got up on the Sabbath and I forgot it was a Sabbath and I picked up something too heavy. I accidentally ran over a squirrel, you know, or whatever. I don't know what the, I'm just using that as a joke, really, but I don't know what the sins are, but they're unintentional sins, or I was ignorant and didn't know that they were a sin. You know, when I was in, I think I've told you this, when we were in Israel, we were staying at one of the hotels, and I forget which one it was. I guess it was the one in, the little lake community. Adrian, what's that? Yeah, Tiberias, that's it, thank you. Staying in Tiberias, and of course we were there on Saturday, so it's Sabbath, and they have special elevators for Sabbath, and they're marked, not where you can see them plainly, but they're marked. And what happens is they can't touch a button because that's work. So they get on the elevator, and the elevator stops on every floor, and they just get on and they get off. They don't touch anything. So Vicki and I are going to go down for breakfast, so we mosey over, and the elevator opens, and we step on. There's a guy standing there in full regalia, you know, and we think, boy, did we screw up big time. And we said, do we need to get off? And he said, no. So I reached up to touch the button. He said, no, don't touch the button. Okay, fine, I know. So we waited until it got to our floor, and then we got off. But those would be ignorant sins, unintentional sins, you know. Yeah, they do. They it's really obvious.
Feel very funny because it's like your first instinct is to leave.
Yeah. And they don't discourage that instinct, although this guy was very polite, which I'll say is not necessarily the case all the time, because the very Orthodox Jews are very rude. They're rude to us, they're rude to their own people, they're rude to everybody. And I don't know why that is, but they are. And so, I mean, these are the guys with the, you know, the curls and the phylacteries and the white socks and the black socks and the whole nine yards. But anyway, they you're a little bit intimidated by them on a Sabbath because, I mean, this stuff is real serious and they take it very serious, as they should. But so anyway, that's an unintentional sin of atonement. In the first month of the 14th day, you're to observe the Passover, a feast lasting 7 days during which you'll eat bread made without yeast. So again, they eat unleavened bread. On that day, the prince is to provide a bull as a sin offering for himself and for all the people of the land. Again, unintentional sins, accidental sins. Every day during the 7 day of the feast, he's to provide 7 bulls, 7 rams, without defect as a burnt offering to the Lord, a male goat for a sin offering. He's to provide a grain offering, an ephah for each bull, and an ephah for each ram, along with a hin of oil for each ephah. Again, don't try to keep track of all the hins and ephahs and baths and whatever, because you'll go crazy. During the 7 days of the feast, which begins in the 7th month of the 15th day, he is to make the same provision for sin offering, burnt offering, and grain offering. The feast here is not clearly identified, but this feast is probably a feast of thanksgiving. We might relate it to the Feast of Tabernacles that they have, although they don't call it the Feast of Tabernacles, but it's a feast of thanksgiving. And so you're thanking him for the grain, you're thanking him for the oil, you're thanking him for that. And that's another feast. So you see a lot of different feasts now than you saw if you are expert on feasts in the Old Testament. During the 7 days of the feast, I think I already read that. So chapter 46. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. The gate of the inner court facing east. Okay, inner court, not outer court. So inner court is the inside of the outer wall. The gate of the inner court facing east to be shut on the 6 working days, but on the Sabbath and on the day of the new moon is to be opened. The prince is to enter from outside through the portico and the gateway to stand by the gatepost. Remember the comment that Ezekiel was to take note of all the entrances and how you come in and how you go out? And while we look at this and we think, I don't understand any of this, of why you go in one, and on some days you go out the one the opposite, and on other days you go out the one you came in. On some days they're closed, you can't go in either in or out of either one. Some of that we understand a little bit, but the priest are to sacrifice his burnt offering and his fellowship offering. Here, another one, a fellowship offering. He is to worship at the threshold of the gateway and then go out, but the gate will not be shut until evening. On the Sabbaths and new moons, the people of the land are to worship in the presence of the Lord at the entrance to that gateway. So the outer gate is to remain closed. Remember that? Because the presence of the Lord came through the outer eastern gate, which is to remain closed. But the inner eastern gate is opened and closed depending on Sabbath or new moon. And that's the gate where the prince does the offering and the atonement and sin offerings and that kind of stuff. The burnt offering the prince brings to the Lord on the Sabbath day is to be 6 male lambs and a ram, all without defect. The grain offering given with the ram is to be an ephah. The grain offering with the lamb is to be as much as he pleases, along with a hin of oil for each ephah. On that day, the new moon, on the day of the new moon, he is to offer a young bull, 6 lambs, and a ram, all without defect. He is to provide a grain offering of 1 ephah with the bull, 1 ephah with the ram, and with the lambs as much as he wants to give, along with a hin of oil for each ephah. I know your eyes are glazing over as we read all this, and mine are too, so I'm lucky I can read it. What I want you to just think about, though, is we talked about the idea that this whole set of chapters, is very detailed. I mean, blindingly detailed. And you wouldn't do that if they didn't mean for this to be literally done. So God wouldn't be doing this detail and make Ezekiel write it down if this was just a metaphor for something else. So even though I don't understand all the comings and goings, I don't understand all of the giving of the sacrifices and the oil and all that, I do believe it's literal. I'm losing my audience to the choir and to the other stuff. I'm getting to the good part now. So verse 8, when the prince enters, he's to go in through the portico of the gateway and he's to come out the same way. Again, you can refer to your other map and see where that is. When the people of the land come before the Lord at the appointed feast, whoever enters by the north gate is to worship, is to go out the south gate. And whoever enters by the south gate is to go out by the north gate. So you're to go through the whole sanctuary if you're a common person. If you're the prince or a priest, you've got different things you got to do. Again, I don't understand all this, but it's here. No one is to return through the gate by which he entered, but each is to go out the opposite gate. The prince is to be among them, going in when they go in, going out when they go out. So at the end of the day, when it's all over, they all go out the same gates. Again, I don't understand it all, but it's all part of it. And I guess in the economy of what God is trying to teach the Jewish people, this will make more sense to them than it does to us as Gentiles. We're not really steeped in the temple processes and procedures. At the festivals and the appointed feasts, the grain offering is to be a ephah with a bull, an ephah with a ram, and with the lambs as much as one pleases, along with a hin of oil for each ephah. When the prince provides a freewill offering to the Lord, whether a burnt offering or fellowship offering, the gate facing east is not to be opened for him. He shall offer his burnt offering or his fellowship offering as he does on the Sabbath day. Then he shall go out, and after he has gone out, the gate will be shut. Every day you are to provide a year-old lamb without defect and burnt offering to the Lord. Morning by morning. You know, I'm sure this is the same in the King James Version. They've left that because morning by morning is part of songs that we sing. And, you know, you've probably heard that talk, that song, morning by morning, you know, his riches I see. And so it's kind of an interesting phrase. And I'm sure that's, if you've got a King James Bible, I'm sure that's what it says. And the NIV has just left it rather than say, and each morning, which is not nearly as beautiful and poetic. But morning by morning you shall provide it. You are also to provide it morning by morning, a grain offering consisting of a sixth of an ephah, a third of a hin of oil, to moisten the flour. The presenting of this grain offering to the Lord is a lasting ordinance. So these are lasting ordinances, which means they are not just temporary, they go on. Why they go on, I don't know. The only thing I can suggest is some of these are prepared by the priests, especially this dough where they take the flour and mix it with the oil, that's prepared for baking. And so the priests take and bake it, and I assume the fellowship feast then is where they all eat this. So I think a lot of these sacrifices provide the food for not only the priests, and remember there's about 28,000 of them in the traditional temple. I don't know how many are here, but 28,000 of them. And that's counting both the Levites and the Zadokites or whatever they're called. And so that's a lot of priests, plus those that work and live in the city and that kind of area. So a lot of people eating some of this stuff. So the lamb and the grain offering and the oil offering shall be provided morning by morning for a regular burnt offering. Doesn't say, it does say morning by morning, regular burnt offering. This is what the sovereign Lord says. If a prince make a gift from his inheritance, this is a change of subject now. So it's not going to be sacrifices now. It's going to be change of subject. So pay attention to this. This is what the sovereign Lord says. If the prince makes a gift of his inheritance to one of his sons, in other words, the land that's marked P on that little chart we looked at, if he gives part of that to one of his sons, it will also belong to his descendants. In other words, it stays in the family. It can't be given outside the family. It is to be their property by inheritance. If, however, he makes a gift from his inheritance to one of his servants, the servant may keep it until the year of freedom, which is the seventh year, the year of Jubilee, and then at that time it will revert back to the prince. So that's the year when you cancel debts. In Jewish history, you cancel monetary debts. A lot of different things happened on Jubilee year. His inheritance belongs to his sons only. It is theirs. The prince must not take any of his inheritance of the people, driving them off their property. He is to give his sons their inheritance out of his own property, so that none of my people will be separated from his property. So again, this is, I won't say this is punishment, but this is like changing the bylaws to make sure that people don't get too creative with what they do. So this is what that is. God has just made a rule now that they're going to have to live by. Then the man, this is the angel, the man brought me through the entrance at the side gate to the sacred rooms facing the north, which belonged to the priest, and showed me a place at the western end. This won't make sense unless you've got that picture that shows the whole temple. He says to me, this is the place where the priest will cook the guilt offering, the sin offering, and bake the grain offering, to avoid bringing them into the outer court and consecrating the people. Then he brought me to the outer court and led me around to its four corners. And I saw in each corner another court. In the four corners of the outer court were enclosed courts, 40 cubits long, 30 cubits wide. Each court in the four corners was the same size. Around the inside of each of the four corners was a ledge of stone with places for fire built all around under the ledge. He said to me, these are the kitchens where those who minister at the temple will cook the sacrifices of the people. So you have kitchens and bake ovens and preparation places for the priests to work, both inside the inner temple and inside the outer temple where the more of the great unwashed come. So, you know, they can prepare the sacrifices out there and they don't take them inside the temple. It's kind of interesting the detail he's gone to. So I'm going to stop here because 47 gets into the river flows out of the temple, and I want to spend a little time on that next week in the boundaries of the land. So read that if you would. Any questions that I can answer in these two chapters?
Not since you put it like that.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of them, I would just say, I'll repeat what I said early, step back away from the detail and look at this in terms of why did God go to this much trouble to lay this out if he didn't want this to be built? Why would he go to such detail of laying out who does what and what gate they come in and what gate they go out and what they can do and what they can't do and where the meat is cooked and where the bread is baked and the exact size of the altar and the Holy of Holies, what's in it, what's not in it, where he stays, you know, where the presence of the Lord is residing. This is, while I don't have all the answers to a plain literal reading of this, I think that's the only reading you can really make that makes any sense. Because if you say this is not literal, it's metaphorical, then it really, you have to ask yourself, why is it even here? Because you could say anything you wanted to say metaphorically in probably two paragraphs. You wouldn't have to put eight chapters in to describe it, you know, the temple area. So even though I can't explain it, I'll explain to you what I understand. Probably even a few things I don't understand, I've tried to explain. But there's a lot I don't understand, and you probably won't understand it either until God is ready to explain it to us. And sooner or later, you'll say, oh yeah, I remember that in Ezekiel. Now it makes perfect sense to me. That's assuming you don't lift up the little page that erases Ezekiel as soon as you walk out of here. You know those little boards kids use where they sketch and then lift it up and the picture goes away?
Etch-a-sketch.
Etch-a-sketch, whatever it is, yeah. So I'm sure most of you do that when you leave, but...
Are they done every day? Are they done by every family, or
Well, it appears they're done by the priests. So it looks like the people bring the animals to the priests, and the priests do the slaughtering and do the preparation of the food. And then the inside priests do the serving of God and the burnt offering. And it's clear they do them to me every feast day, and they do them every Sabbath, and they do them every new moon. And I assume because it says daily, day by day, morning by morning, that some of them are every single day. And again, that of course, that leads to the question of why sacrifices in the millennial kingdom, and other than what we've talked about before, I don't know how to explain it.
They bring their animals in, I guess, and they pen them, put them in a pen.
I assume they do. Doesn't say, but I assume they do. And of course, you know, they bring them in from all over the country. As you'll see next week, you'll see where all the tribes are. So they have to make these pilgrimages to come in, or they have to, you know, bring the priests so many of these to hold for the daily sacrifices. I don't know how that's going to work. You know, I'm sure they'll work out the procedure somehow, but I don't know. More I don't know than I do know.
He's busy.
Good question, though. Yeah, oh, yeah, the priests are busy.
Seems to me every family must be forced to have animals.
Well, I think they do.
To sacrifice.
I mean, he doesn't mention the Kroger or the Ingles or the Publix down the street where they go pick up their meat. So my guess is they're an agricultural society like they are now. Yeah. Any other questions that I can answer? Okay. Well, let's have a word of prayer. And if you'll read 47 and 48, hopefully we'll finish next week. And I'll try to summarize, not the whole book of Ezekiel, but I'll try to summarize why I think it's important and what's important for us to take away from this as we go forward. Very important prophet, very important time for God to speak to us today as well as them. So let's have a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you for this time that we've been able to come and talk. And Lord, we don't understand all that we read. We don't understand all that's written. But Lord, through your Spirit and through your Word, I know that as time goes on and as we are supposed to understand, we will. And Lord, I pray that those who need to serve and those who need to do all of the work called out here will begin to put together and piece together all that has to happen. And through your Spirit, you'll guide them. And Lord, through your presence in the temple, you'll guide them. And Lord, they will see your hand in a mighty way. Lord, I pray for the service to come. I pray for the pastor and all those who perform and the report from the VBS. I pray, Lord, that everything be done to your honor and glory, and that when people leave today, they understand they've been in the house of the Lord and they've come and they've had a worshipful experience to worship you and lift it all to you. Lord, we thank you for everything you do in our lives, and we ask that you go with us now for the remainder of this day and for the week, and pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thank you all.